So this question is for Bill and anybody else who wants to field it. I was appalled as a vegan to see that I'm contributing that dramatically to rainforest destruction. I wondered if you could say a little bit more about soybeans versus cattle, whether veganism and vegetarianism are destroying the world or saving it. And also whether, if you know, whether there's any difference in terms of the impacts on forests between organic or non-GMO soybeans and regular soybeans.
All of us, whether we're vegans, vegetarians, or meat eaters, are impacting the rainforest, that's for sure. Palm oil is vegans are often shocked to learn that palm oil's in their what is it?
Earth balance,
yeah, that's the stuff. But, you know, I think that one of the big drivers for soybean expansion in the Amazon, there's two big drivers for soybean expansion in the Amazon. One is this biofuels mandates in the United States. And so there's a lot more demand for corn, for ethanol, and that's displacing soybean production in the United States. And that soybean production is expanding in Brazil, and it's driving cattle and sometimes directly into the Amazon and directly converting rainforests. It's called the indirect land use change effect. And when you look at the emissions associated with, when you bring that in, and you look at the emissions associated with producing corn ethanol as a substitute for gasoline, actually, the corn ethanol has higher climate impact than the gasoline. So that's one issue. The other thing is that's driving soybean is the switch to meat diets, and particularly around the world as people are moving up and mimicking the American diet sort of preference. It takes a lot of soy protein to raise chickens and beef, and so that's a big driver as well. So I would say vegetarians have a lesser impact on forests than meat eaters, but no, we all have some impacts. I think the GMO versus conventional, it's a bigger issue around agriculture and what constitutes sustainable agriculture and what GMO soybeans make possible, which is just buckets and buckets of pesticides to completely eliminate the diversity of natural that exists in the farms and impose, you know, easily cheap monocultures of soybeans on those landscapes. And that's really what it's about. It's about simplification and vast simplification of our agricultural landscapes.
As the rest of the country turned right, here in California, we managed to at least stay neutral or turn a little left. And one of the most important things we did was defeat Prop 23.
Yes.
I've been doing my own thinking about what lessons we learned from that and how we can export those lessons throughout the rest of the country. And I'm curious from anyone in the panel what insights you've had regarding the kind of really broad-based coalition we were able to create, which did not include a lot of enemy making.
I think, do people know the Prop 23 story? Most folks, heads nodding. I think one of the big lessons from Prop 23 was really being honest, though, about who was behind it. One of the most successful parts of that many people did was point out that almost all of the funding, do people remember the percentage? It was astronomical. In the 90s, it was coming from a couple Texas oil companies, really trying to take down California's clean air laws and global warming legislation. So I think that being honest about the fact that we do have opposition out there and that people are actively pushing back is going to be key. And I think that as we move forward, really calling out the big polluters, calling them out by name, and really targeting them, and doing it in a way that is, you know, both confrontational, but also humorous as well, to really point out just the complete falsehoods of what they're putting out there is going to be really key. The second piece that I would add is that there really was a great coalition, as you were saying. It spanned from community groups on up to clean tech companies and others really seeing that, okay, maybe we're not going to agree about every way that we do this, but at least we'll be in the same room and really start pushing forward. That can improve, I think. Prop 23 wasn't perfect by any means, but it was a really successful fight. So I think that is a cause for hope going forward.
Just a short follow-up note to that. It's important to note, you know, some of the allies that were formed that were lacking on the national arena. like the deep alliances with labor, you know, some of the more conservative unions like the Teamsters were the first ones out the door to oppose Prop 23. This is something we need to keep in mind nationally, and what the climate movement nationally and internationally has failed to do is really build the solid, deep alliances we need in the House of Labor with the working poor and specifically with the leadership of the frontline environmental and climate justice communities. It's also worth noting that on the eve, on the day after the election, I happened to be in the East Coast and got an email from a friend here and learned about the very successful campaign in Richmond where 200 plus volunteers went out onto the streets, not door to door, and took out a $2 million Chevron campaign to unseat the local city hall. And that's where our power is, and that's where we really need to kind of rethink our strategies.
Thank you. Dr. Henry Clark of West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond. First of all, I want to say that I was in Copenhagen, and I think that we need to stress the fact that we are already suffering the consequences of climate change, not trying to stop it from beginning. It's already happening. You know, as many people, leaders said in Copenhagen, especially the leaders from the Maldives Island, they're already flooding. People already are suffering the consequences. The other point is that sure agree we should use the Clean Air Act, the environmental justice and climate justice laws that are on the books, but I think we need to get plain and clear, like Armando said, you know, and I say that we should push the system to the limits that it would produce some results for us. But Obama is not for no environmental justice, period, no climate justice. He talk out of both sides of his lying head. He'll say he support, you know, climate justice or whatever. But then, on the other hand, he want to build more nuclear plants, which our movement fought off during the 60s, and now the administration is trying to take advantage of the, in their thinking that we're weak and they could come back with it and shove them down our throats. The last point is this, is that we're talking about all these different greenhouse gases, polluters, and international gangsters like Chevron and many others. But the fact is that the U.S. military is the biggest greenhouse gas polluter there is in the country, and they're not even in the discussion, period. They wasn't part of any discussion in Copenhagen, and I'm not hearing that they were part of any discussion in Cancun. So we need to really look at who's the greenhouse gangster, and the biggest one is the U.S. military.
Check, check, check.
If you have, I was just going to add something about 1.2 in terms of the observation that you made that as a journalist covering the Cancun climate negotiations and also the meetings that led up to it, the interstitial ones in Bonn, this was the first time that I saw country after country after country get up during the negotiations and start not with their contribution to the discussions, but with back home in my country, this is going on right now. And typically their head of state was still coming. Venezuela, Ecuador had incredible floods going on. Philippines had, I think, a record 10 number of tropical storms. This is all just December, in addition to what Michelle mentioned, the fires in Russia and also the Pakistan floods. And this is a real situation on the ground for many people around the world. And I think that's probably obvious to most people in the room here, but I think when I'm asked the question of what does one do with the climate skeptics, my response is to tell these stories. It's also the grounds-up stories. I was at a press conference by AOSIS, the Alliance of Small Island States, which was just mentioned, you know, the rising sea levels are suffering. The Africa group was there, and the least developed countries were there. And the stories that they have to tell are just unbelievable. I mean, if you read just the opening pages of Bill McKibben's Earth, it also comes up there that this is now times. This is not, you know, grandchildren is a word that's often used in titles of books or when politicians talk about this issue, what's going to affect grandchildren or children. And that's something that I think, coming back from UN, I saw very clearly there. So just to add to that point, my observations.
I just wanted to also like reiterate what I believe you were saying, Dr. Clark, which I totally agree with, which I think we need to link these different strategies. We heard a lot of different strategies up here, a lot of different tools in the toolbox, everything from the Clean Air Act to grassroots organizing to art to consumer boycotts. All of these different pieces are so much more powerful. You know, I completely agree that the work we're doing to enforce the Clean Air Act, I really want to talk more with folks about the ways in which they think in their community that can link into grassroots organizing, that can be supportive of and not detract from and push, because I think all of these things are really much more powerful when they're in some way linked and joined together, and that, I think that is the way. I don't think there's one magic answer, but I think together we can really have an impact, and I'm hoping that these conversations continue in ways in which we can link our work together better.
My name's Leila Salazar-Lopez. I work with Amazon Watch, and at the last minute, I had the opportunity to be able to go to Cancun to mostly to learn, because I've never been to anything like this before, but my other main objective was to support indigenous allies from the Amazon and support also IEN, and they're amazing. I was very, very blown away by the work of IEN in Cancun, and I just wanted to say, since it wasn't said, in case anybody's confused by what some people have said about what the Indigenous Caucus, what their position was around RED, the Indigenous Caucus, which represents many, kind of a network of Indigenous people at the UN climate negotiations, met every morning, just like many caucuses met every morning. And the overall, and correct me anybody if anybody wants to add who was actually there too, the overall position of the Indigenous Caucus, which I was observing every day, was that they are completely against the carbon market. And some people were saying, well, you know, some members of the Indigenous Caucus support RED, and you know, some of them support RED with rights, and some of them are against RED. That is true, and I wanted to bring that up because someone had mentioned that there are divisions, and there are divisions, and I think RED is what is causing the divisions, and I think that a lot of these market mechanisms are what causing these market mechanisms, and I know that even you know, just in accompanying some of our allies, this was very, very, very prominent. But I think in the end, the position of the Indigenous Caucus was we're against market mechanisms. And one of the things I learned there, and this is leading to my question, was we were at a presentation of the Acra Caucus, which is a coalition of groups that works with forest and forest-dependent peoples and peoples that work allies of forest and forest-dependent peoples. And they were giving a presentation, and the question of the California MOU with Acre and Chiapas came up, and I had no idea. I didn't even know that had come about. And as more and more through the week, we started talking about it, and then when we got back, people, there was, you know, presentations about it in Sacramento, and I started learning that one of our best friends here in the Bay Area, Chevron, is one of the biggest promoters and lobbyists for this this RED MOU between Chiapas and Acre. And the reason I mentioned this, and I also mentioned what was happening with the Indigenous Caucus, is that I think that this will create many divisions. At least I'll speak for what I know in the Amazon. It will create many divisions. And I think it's up to us from California to learn more about how Chevron's involved in this or other companies are involved in this, and challenge it and monitor it and speak out about it. So I don't know if anybody has any ideas about that, or, you know, a lot of people ask me too, well, if, you know, Indigenous people are against RED, is there another way that RED could be implemented without the UN process or without, you know, governments? Is there a way that it could be done independently? Is there independent financing that could be done? And, you know, I think that's very complicated. So I don't know if anybody has a comment on that.
Sorry for talking. Yeah, so one of the things which has occurred last month, as many of you know, is that the California Air Resources Board voted on its final rules for our cap and trade system, our carbon trading system in California. And this was a culmination of a 2-year rules-making process. But with respect to the RED, or forest carbon credits, which will make it into California's trading system, the window of opportunity to influence those rules is longer. We have the opportunity this year, in fact, when the Governor's Forest and Climate Task Force, which is the kind of organizing kind of body that is going to be developing RED standards, will be kind of developing its rules. And it's not just actually with for example, Chiapas and Acre, but it's with Aceh, Indonesia. There's, I think, now 7 or 9 different provinces spread out between Mexico, Brazil, and Indonesia that are working to get, that have an MOU with California to sell RED credits. And so there is a huge opportunity here that we can have. You know, California, if we go through with this RED program, it will be the first and so far only what they call compliance-grade RED credits in the world, meaning the only carbon market in the world where RED credits qualify as a type of carbon offset that can be traded, and then in exchange, it would allow polluters in California to continue polluting. And I'll just share one quick little example of a story. When I was in a meeting this past year with respect to RED, there was a carbon market promoter who really wanted to see RED happen. And the problem, one of the reasons why RED credits have not been allowed to be let into, for example, the European emissions trading system, is because there's lots and lots of problems, not with only with respect to land grabbing and indigenous rights and respect for indigenous land tenure, and some of the methodological problems that Bill mentioned with respect to calculating carbon emissions and stuff like that. There's been so many problems that these credits aren't qualified to be used in carbon trading systems in other countries. And one of the carbon market proponents on this call said, well, we know that they're really risky. We know that a RED credit probably won't actually be very good. So maybe we should just, require somebody to earn 2 RED credits and they'll only qualify for 1. Because you know what? If we actually try to answer these questions of environmental integrity and indigenous rights, companies might not buy RED credits. They might buy other offsets or even reduce their emissions in California. So that gives you a little bit of a sense of the kinds of input, I think, that the Air Resources Board and the Governor's Forest and Climate Task Force, a bit of a flavor of those conversations and why we need to be involved.
Thanks for those comments and the insights into the Indigenous Caucus and issues. I think the point about Chevron and the big polluters generally is it's something that we need to do a better job of unmasking. I mean, the coal industry and the utilities that burn all this coal are, the number one proponents of killing any action on climate, and they're also the biggest proponents for RED, and I think that tells you something right there.
Just an afterthought to that, Leila. A lot of us who work with frontline communities and networks of activist groups, we apply a fairly simplistic filter, but I think it's a very appropriate filter. I mean, for me, in my work, when dealing with communities faced with new and improved technologies of burning, that they're faced with on a daily basis, or waste workers who are wondering if carbon markets can actually finance their livelihoods. The simple filter is, are these solutions community-based, or are they in the corporate arena? Are they in a policy arena that's dominated by the corporates, as opposed to in a public arena that is controlled by democratic process? And whether we look at market-based solutions like RED, or technological solutions like plasma gasification and processes, I think it's easy to make a distinction between those solutions that communities can afford and implement and guide and control, and those that we can't.
Hi, I'd like to know if 350.org has picked a day for this coming October, and if you have any theme or anything. because I need to start planning. And also, I wanted to know if you could just talk a little bit about how to get the mainstream media to start connecting the dots.
You can't, said someone in the crowd. As for a day of action, we have not fully settled, but there rumor has it that something may be cooking. You know, just to take one step back, one of the reasons that at 350 we've really focused on doing these large-scale global mobilizations is not because it's the only tactic that makes an impact, but it's a way to kind of bring a movement together and to get the attention of the mainstream media in many ways and to really create the type of momentum we need to be organizing throughout the year. And as your question hinted at, oftentimes the organizing that happens around these days lasts for months and months and has lots of different campaigns involved. So one of the themes that we're considering this year and would love people's ideas and feedbacks is we've kind of been thinking about what's a tactic that can get lots of people out into the streets, is a way that is a symbol of really the solutions that we want, as well as the people we're trying to take on, is something that's global, so that everybody around the world can take part, no matter where they live, and it's something that kind of taps into existing networks of people that are out there. So one of the things we've been thinking about is bicycles. Is there a way that from Beijing to DC, from Chicago to Bujumbura, all around the world, we can find a way to turn out tens of thousands of people in the street riding bikes, from parades that are positive to people actually occupying areas, from people using them not only as a mode of transportation, but a way to charge a cell phone or grind grain or show a movie? Is there a way that we can take this simple two-wheeled thing and turn it into a real political instrument and a creative instrument that starts bringing our communities together? So it's going to be a challenge, and we're still exploring whether this is an idea that can really take off and tap in to something out there, but we're excited to work with people to figure out if this is something to take forward, and I think within the next week or two, we'll kind of be coalescing around something like that. So that's kind of the hint, but we're looking at the fall, maybe not just one day, but trying, no pun intended, to make this a bit more of a rolling day of action as well. And just finally, quickly on the media piece of it, it's worth noting there's a study out there that people can Google, I forget exactly what it is, maybe someone else knows, that media coverage this year plummeted on climate change. A large part of that is because papers were laying off staff. Another part is I think that reporters are getting lazy, and not folks like The Nation, of course, but elsewhere, really aren't picking up on the narratives that are out there. They're kind of just looking at Congress, just looking at the Hill, just looking at the UN, and completely missing a lot of the exciting stories that Ananda and others were pointing out about what's happening in Richmond, what's happening in frontline communities, the solutions that are out there, and doing the real investigative reporting we need to dig into the boondoggles like Red, which are happening right now. So I think it's a challenge for all of us to keep pushing the mainstream media and really demanding more coverage of these issues. And again, getting creative ourselves to figure out what are the things that will gain the attention of the media so that we can really begin to use it as a megaphone for the work that's happening out there. So I think the mainstream media isn't dead. There's still chances to use that as a real positive force for change, but it's definitely going to be a challenge going forward.
I guess I feel like somebody who participates in the media and works for them that you know, I don't want to represent mainstream media because I don't and never have. But I think one of the issues is getting the one of the problems is getting the issue of climate change or any environmental topics into mainstream media. New York Times has a green blog that I think does a good job of getting word out there. Guardian UK has a good environment page, and those are about the two that I can name off the top of my head. I could get into all sorts of geeky websites that one can go to as well, and I'm sure half a dozen people in this room could as well, beyond those two, just to keep it brief. As somebody who works in leftist media, I have a very hard time, I can't agree more with what Jamie just said, I have a very hard time getting any stories out there that are from the ground up, whether that means population groups or direct action. It is exactly what Jamie just said. It's climate legislation, US climate legislation. Last time I checked, there's not a lot to report there. So where do we have the issue of the environment in the media? A lot of different kinds of direct actions that are happening around climate change just aren't getting coverage. And this has to do with budgets that people have. So, which is, you know, those are all related things. So that's I think, one of the issues in terms of whether or not it gets represented and then how it gets represented and what gets represented. Bolivia is about the only country that I can occasionally bring in with certain media, but in a very particular way. But when I tried to talk about least developed, basically my experience at the UN is that the majority of the countries want a renewal of Kyoto, and they're talking about the issues in their home countries, and they want financing. And to tell that story that way is almost impossible. So if I say the Africa group, the least developed countries, the Alliance of Small Island States, most countries want to see Kyoto, you know, with all its caveats. I'm not saying Kyoto's great. But they want to see it renewed. They're opposed to Copenhagen Accord or the Cancun Agreement, neither of which are legally binding. And here's the reasons why. That story typically doesn't fly. It doesn't get picked up. So, I mean, as somebody who works in media, that's just from my angle of it, my end of it, that's how that looks.
What do you think about the climate changes here now that, you know, mentioned before as being more of a media story?
As an actual issue, I think almost every story in order to change the narrative, I personally think that every story needs to have the climate change is here now, and here's a group that's experiencing it in there, because then one immediately gets at some of the things that Ananda was rightly bringing up, or some of the people who are, you know, asking questions or making comments or bringing up some of the most hardest hit impacted communities who did the least to cause this issue and have the least resources to deal with it are immediately telling their own stories, and they are ones of impact. And then the elephant in the room kind of emerges as, like, what's the problem is the question that ends up coming out, and the elephant in the room is right there. So it's a different way of grappling with reshuffling the deck, I guess. It's a different way of retelling the narrative that does a number of things. Yeah, but that's hard. Okay, thank you for your patience.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. What I came to make was an informal announcement of a couple of us who got together 37 years ago, have come together after talking and created a network that's around the world to a lot of high-powered thinkers, particularly in high tech, of a new initiative that's different than the 350.org approach. We start from business as usual and say that we want the best climate possible, and the best climate possible is to do climate justice to Africa, which is to have a dark green Sahara again, because it was green 6,000 years ago. But this would require making sure that Iceland doesn't, you know, melt, and so there are specific meltwater control mechanisms for that. It also works with seeing African leapfrog from the bottom position now to having the most advanced infrastructure in the world, particularly in transportation, because the big countries say they're locked in, they can't put in the most advanced ones. We're saying, oh, okay, Africa's not locked in, haven't developed it yet. So they're going to get the best in the world. So they'll be selling transportation equipment to the world, they'll be selling supplementary irrigation equipment to the world, they'll have the world's greatest city, and the world will have an entire continent which can run on biofuel, and essentially they'll be selling biofuel technology to the rest of the world. So. Anyway, we want people's feedback on this informally, because we're not formally announcing it yet.
Thank you. Go to the back and then come back up to the front.
Okay. Hi, my name is Susan Silber. I'm a longtime community organizer and environmental educator. I'm working with a group called Kids Versus Global Warming, which was started by a kid named Alex Lors, who is now 15. And 16, he realized that kids have an absolute moral authority to speak up and tell policy leaders that this is our future. You need to do something about climate change. So this group is organizing a march on Mother's Day, 2011, and trying to get youth all over the world to march on the streets and say, we need to do something about climate change. And the flagship march is actually in San Francisco. So if you have kids, you work with kids, you care about kids, please come out to the march on Mother's Day. It's called the I Matter March, and we're actually trying to get 350 involved as well. And lots of other partners involved. So I also want to mention that I'm working with a group called the Transition Town Movement, which is an international movement really trying to organize communities around being much more resilient and really localizing communities. We launched it on the 10-10-10 day action, organized about 30 events in Berkeley in conjunction with 350.org. And we're launching again on February 23rd at the Ecology Center. So we're going to be having a lecture about how Berkeley can organize a transition town movement. Right. So 7 o'clock at the Ecology Center. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey guys, my name is Ashley. I know a lot of you personally, and I like you, and there are great people in this room. And so thanks for organizing this event. I love the idea of people coming together, talking about the future of the climate justice movement, and I know we don't have much time, so I'll make this pretty quick. I've heard a lot of good points about how we do move the climate justice movement forward. And speaking of elephants in the room, I think there are a lot of people here who focus on justice side of it maybe a little more, and how we do have a lot of laws on a lot of the books and a lot of the nations in the world that support corporations and support the polluters and at the expense of the people. And I was wondering, as leaders of the climate movement, just a real quick answer from all of you, and I know you're all involved in different degrees, but maybe on a personal level, at what, especially if we're going to invoke MLK, you know, at what point or what value has nonviolent civil disobedience in the future of the climate movement? And what moral obligation do you think we have to start promoting that as leaders of the climate movement? Thanks.
I was talking before about all the tools. That's clearly one of the tools that we really haven't used in this movement that needs to be on the table. I don't think it's the end all answer. I don't think any of these things are, but I definitely think we need to step it up as, you know, in a way that is much more aggressive, and much more bold, much more ambitious, and that is one way to do that.
I would agree as well. I think that, time and time again, we've heard that, as Ananda put it, you know, change is not going to come from Washington, change is going to come to Washington. And so, as Rose said, we need every tool in the toolkit, and I think it's time for us to start thinking a lot more about how to really help build a mass movement. Looking back, every really successful wide mass movement has, gone out into the streets. And I think that nonviolent civil disobedience has to be probably more. It probably has a more and more of a future in the climate justice movement for sure.
Definitely. Quickly, Bill McKibben and Michael Brun and then Becky Tarbottom from RAN, Rainforest Action Network, all put out a letter earlier on last year kind of asking for ideas about civil disobedience and kind of putting out an open call saying that now really is a time to step things up. And so at 350.org, that's something we're definitely taking seriously. It's an interesting question for us, and I think for a lot of people, both organizationally and then just individually, is that I think we all want to find a way to really speak the truth and do tactics that have that moral urgency and look back on the great traditions that we have in this country of civil disobedience, from MLK to the suffragettes to, you know, the good old Tea Party. The original one. I think it's also important to remember that it is part of a toolbox, and that I think that thinking about it like that and doing it in a way that really does carry that moral urgency, but also is open-handed in some ways to involving lots of people and done in a real way that's exciting and feels kind of different for folks, is important. One idea just to float out there to get people thinking in this direction is, and this is coming from Bill McKibben, who, you know, we kind of think, and as the young folks at 350, it should be youth out there on the front lines. And Bill was saying, hey, you know, maybe let's let the grandparents and parents do it this time. And we'll, you know, people who were born before the Eisenhower administration or something like that. And the message could kind of be, you know, I want to outlive this coal plant that, you know, is out there. Or I want my grandkids to breathe fresh air, and maybe we'll kind of put a new face on the usual folks who are kind of chaining themselves down. So I think, you know, I think there's good way. Can you picture the guy in a walker kind of handcuffed to the gun? So I think there's good ways to start really thinking creatively as well about how we can do civil disobedience in a way that kind of catches the attention and doesn't just box it in as kind of, oh, those are the radical activists. But no, those are real citizens speaking truth to power and really honoring the great traditions in this country of people really, you know, putting their bodies on the line for something they believe in.
Well, at RAND, we do a lot of nonviolent direct action. It's really a privilege to work with some wonderful organizers. Scott Parkin, who's been working in mountaintop removal coal mining and working with communities there in Appalachia. They helped organize an Appalachia Rising in Washington, D.C., where over 100 people got arrested. You know, Al Gore is famous for saying, having said, or in some circles anyway, you know, I don't understand why the youth of the world isn't sitting down and blockading construction of new coal power plants. We don't understand why Al Gore isn't joining us.
I had to kind of think about this one, and you know, thanks to my co-panelists for kind of shaping my thoughts here, because I think I'd like to start by saying one of the reasons I moved here to the Berkeley is because of all of you and people like my friend Bill, who were part of amazing nonviolent direct action-led movements that shifted frames, that prevented the build-out of the nuclear power industry back in the 80s, that, you know, brought civil rights to this nation, that historically back from my roots kicked empire out of the far reaches, you know, of colonial empire. And so I came here with an interest in working with people who have had not only vast experience, but have been able to pass on that experience through the generations from, you know, I look around the crowd and there's many of you who've been involved with past anti-war and disarmament struggles that were led by nonviolent direct action to current day environmental justice fights and other issues, social justice issues. Here in the Bay Area. So I think while we need to reflect on this history and the privilege, it comes with a certain privilege and also responsibility that needs to be shared out. There's a reason why, you know, we sometimes feel like an enclave or a bubble, why zero waste hasn't expanded beyond California or certain issues or gay rights haven't expanded beyond San Francisco. I mean, there's some fundamental issues we need to look at in our organizing strategies here. And I think when I look, I think the difference in how perhaps we talk about direct action is I would say that groups that have identified direct action as a tactic have marginalized the role of direct action. Direct action is an organizing strategy. You know, when we reflect on how direct action has shifted empire, it's because it has empowered masses. It has shifted the frame so that the leadership from the bottom can rise up to the top and that we can challenge current power structures and systems that are currently brokering the destruction of this planet. So if we want to really move away and make a radical shift, I think we need to be very conscious about how we shift our resources, how we shift our, you know, within the world of climate activists, how we shift our resources towards more grassroots organizing and movement building, towards supporting our brothers and sisters who are willing to lay it on the line and go to jail for us and bail them out from time to time, to providing the legal support, providing the organizing resources required to make this a mass movement. We have a lot of policymakers in DC. We've got great minds sitting around this table who can help us craft the messages, the policy pieces. We don't need any more. You know, the people joining the movement now need to be mobilized on the streets with the wisdom and experience of all of you.
So I've heard a lot about false solutions when it comes to financing. And really quickly, I'd like to ask whoever wants to jump in about positive solutions that we should be fighting for. That could be like the Tobin tax or bunker finance or whatever else.
So yes, I think that there are a lot of people working on climate finance that are wondering, well, where are we going to get what they call the quantum of finance? Where are we going to get the big old chunk of change that we need in order to provide developing countries with climate finance adaptation mitigation? There is a bill that will be introduced, that was introduced in the last session, that will be reintroduced. It is a financial transactions tax, very similar to a Tobin tax, which some of you may have heard of, which I think it would essentially take Wall Street speculation, which is notoriously undertaxed and underregulated, and would subject currency transactions, currency trades that are over a certain amount, which would mean those hedge funds, for example, that move hundreds of millions of dollars worth of currency trades at a time and subject that to a 0.01% tax. This would raise potentially billions worth of climate finance. And if you were an actual company, let's say, that needed to export or import something, if you needed to send money abroad, and you had a legitimate reason for converting some currency, this wouldn't deter you. And it would be very, very little sort of impact on your business. If, on the other hand, you were trying to do it to gain money, then purely just to gain money, then there would be you might be a little bit deterred, although there would be some people that would still do it, and in that case they would be taxed. So legislation is going to be introduced by Pete Stark next session. It's going to be hard. It's a tax bill, and we aren't facing a very kind of tax-living Congress right now. It really is all, the new Congress really is all about making government smaller and lowering taxes. So it's going to be a tough road to hoe, but that's one of the solutions that's potential solutions that's being proposed actually abroad in Europe, and trying to galvanize support in the U.S. for this, even if we don't think we're going to win it, could really have some positive knock-on effects for our allies in Europe that have a better chance in heck of getting something like this through.
I think to add to that, I think today I was reading Financial Times, Innovation, Energy, a special section on climate change and how to address it. And the article on the second page there, Chinese President Hu Jintao is in DC right now. I've been grappling with why China, and there's certainly lots of things one could say positive and negative about China, but in terms of its energy, why it's done such a good job of shifting funds from fossil fuel into fossil fuel energies to renewable energies. And they just had astronomical growth. And one of the things that was pinpointed in the article that I was reading on the way over here that makes it really hard in the US, I'm sure a lot of people could chime in about a lot of the problems. But one of the things that they were pinpointing is that with the tax credits that are available in order to make wind energy possible, and I spoke with somebody, I've written about this, I have a couple of articles on Alternet and Grist about this that I've co-authored with a woman named Lucia Green-Weiskill, who works with a Beijing-based nonprofit specifically on energy. One of the problems in getting renewable energy going here that China is very good at is looking at the long-term funding for renewable energy. And in the US, we have tax credits. And when I was in Cancun, I spoke with somebody from the American Wind Energy Association. And there is a tax credit that was set to expire in December. And he said, basically, the expiration of that tax credit is just going to see wind energy plummet. And it's a similar thing with solar. Lucia and I wrote about this in terms of the solar industry. The Obama administration just in January threw its weight behind the U.S. Steel. Was it the Steelworkers Union? Steelworkers. Yeah. Critiquing basically, it's a WTFO complaint that they filed, complaining basically about the way that the Chinese government is subsidizing wind energy. And I think that's no way to get renewable energy momentum going in this country is to start, having these kinds of fights with China. Steve Chu, our energy secretary, has referred to this as a Sputnik moment where we might have an energy race, right? He said that in December at a press conference in DC, where we might have an energy race going on with China. I'd like to see such an energy race if it's mostly focused on renewable energy, clean technology obviously being a totally different issue that's vexed and fraught with all sorts of problems. So I guess that would be my 2 cents to the financing end of things. Questions?
Hey, I'm Andrew. I'm with Making Contact, the guy recording this. I didn't hear anybody today mention Cochabamba, and I'm wondering, especially with a little time to reflect now after that post-Copenhagen conference, the significance of what happened in Cochabamba, especially in light of the narrative that seems to be coming out in terms of people-led solutions to climate change. So if anybody has anything to say about what happened there and where that is going.
So just to transition into that, there was an alternative People's World Conference on Climate Change that Evo Morales convened in Bolivia in April. That's what's being asked about.
I think just quickly, I think there was a lot of really important work that happened in Cochabamba on a number of fronts. You know, we had a lot of folks from 350 there. I wasn't myself. But one, on the organizing front, there were incredibly important conversations and alliances that were building there that have continued to really have an impact going forward. And I think that as we look at the kind of growing movement internationally, having more forums or fora for people to really come together and articulate strategy beyond just policy is going to be really important. As people have mentioned, the meetings now, at least the UN Framework Convention meetings, move to South Africa in Durban. Already in South Africa, there have been lots of conversations across the board from big NGOs on down to community groups about how do we use this as a moment to really talk about movement strategy in South Africa and across the continent. And those are discussions that I think are really hopeful. The second piece of Cochabamba, of course, was the People's Accord that came out of it and a lot of principles of that. I think that it's a really intriguing thing that hasn't maybe moved forward as much as it could have. I think that there's room, actually, in the UN FCCC and in Congress and elsewhere, and more importantly in the public, to really begin to articulate some more of the solutions that we really want and to lay out more of a framework of what we're asking for. I think part of what we saw in Cancun was that there was a vacuum for the first week and a half. People were kind of wandering around saying, you know, what's exactly happening? The U.S. wasn't wandering around. The big polluters weren't wandering around. They were pushing an agenda behind the scenes because they knew exactly what they wanted, even though it wasn't on the table quite yet. I think that civil society needs to be doing exactly the same thing, that we can't just be going in and reacting to what is being put in front of us and saying, you know, we don't want this, but really aggressively talking about what we do want and having some real unity around that. That's tough. There's a lot of different perspectives on the table, but I think Cochabamba helped coalesce a lot of that, at least for part of the movement, and that opening up that discussion and bringing that forward and pushing that forward as we move through these different meetings and as we move through the kind of movement in the public is going to be really important. So hopefully, I think that work is continuing. And it is continuing. I mean, Ananda talked about the meetings that happened, but I think it could even accelerate. And I know that we're hoping to play kind of more of a role as much as we can as well.
One important, I guess, thing to note, Cochabamba inspired a lot of our fellow activists who were able to attend from the US to come back and start look at themselves and their organizing on the front lines as playing a national leadership role. So there's been some coming together of frontline communities here in the US that have been active in Climate Justice Now and other international climate justice gatherings, and in an effort to build alignment on what is a very strong people-based platform on the climate crisis and the associated economic crisis. So there's a lot of, I guess, meetings right now to kind of really discover that identity. It should be acknowledged, like most of the organizations in Cochabamba, most of these groups are, as I mentioned earlier, ill-resourced groups, frontline community groups, environmental justice communities that receive a fraction of the funding that the larger nonprofit world dishes out. And so it takes time, it takes process, but these are all also the folks who are throwing the wrenches into those coal power plant and incinerator and oil refinery proposals. So I think there's a direct link, I think, that needs to be fostered between a people's movement here and global solidarity efforts.
I think I would probably just add, having also been in Bolivia, I notice energy is waning, so I'll keep this brief. In Bolivia, it was organized intending to sort of get out of the gridlock that the UN climate negotiations have been in, and to also sidestep the states and their negotiators. I mean, it's a people's world conference. So there's actually, people from various people's groups, but self-organized as such, who were in Bolivia. NGOs as well, but one of the things that I thought was really amazing being there is this overwhelming propensity of indigenous groups from different Andean countries and the kinds of things that they had to say. Very strong anti-red position. It was mentioned earlier by a woman who's here that red is a very complicated and divisive issue. I couldn't agree more. But that very strong anti-red position, 17 working groups official. There was one unofficial that was outside of the official meeting grounds that was organized, which gets into a whole other range of topics. But in terms of whose voices were represented and what they had to say outside the UN framework, I think for that reason the People's World Conference on Climate Change in Bolivia was an amazing success. And to see the energy put in preventing it. So at the beginning of the interstitial meetings at the UN in Bonn, people get to make announcements. And it's unbelievable to see how many times Bolivia attempting to say, here's our agreement, was just shut down. And finally, Pablo Solon, true in keeping with his very calm demeanor, but that does, toe the ethical line of keeping voices out there, he said, you keep shutting us out. And so I actually would like to now make this announcement. And there was no way of getting around him, this was in June, of finally making this announcement. But that's already, you're already seeing an allegedly open forum, the UN, also allegedly an open forum, pushing down there against the People's Accord. So, yeah. Maybe just like one or two more questions, or how are people doing? People are tired? Yeah? Okay. Why don't you come up and discuss with people if you want. Thanks so much, everyone, for coming.